Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. I'm very pleased to say, for the first time, I believe, we have with us a man who knows from wherever he speaks about matters involving intelligence, particularly about an area of the world that is, he calls it the most dangerous and complicated region on Earth, and I think that's no understatement by any means. Let me just introduce Avi Melamed, Fellow of Intelligence and Middle East Affairs for the Eisenhower Institute of the Gettysburg College. We're delighted to have him with us. Avi Melamed, welcome. Thank you very much for taking a few minutes.
Thank you, Frank. Thank you for having me. My pleasure.
I wanted to start with sort of a response, if I could get it from you, to what President Obama said yesterday at the Central Intelligence Agency, an organization I'm sure you're very familiar with, about the status of the effort, as he put it, to degrade and ultimately destroy the Islamic State.
Yes, I believe that President Obama is reflecting to a large extent, talking about it in the context of the military reality on the ground. I'm not so sure that he is referring to the other aspect of this phenomenon, because I think it's very important to internalize that in the end of the day, successfully confronting the challenge that ISIS and other militant Islamist groups present requires a much more cohesive understanding of the phenomenon. I'm not so sure that this understanding exists in different Western circles.
Well, I fear that's absolutely correct. And how would you characterize a correct understanding of that threat?
Well, you know, Frank, let's start with something that is not. You know, I heard more than once in some circles in the West, including some very influential people, that actually try to associate the emergence of ISIS with the phenomenon of global warming. This is a very short-sighted, not to say ridiculous, outlook. And this is very disturbing, because if you want to really to address the challenge, you have to really understand the deep roots that gives birth to the phenomenon of ISIS and others. You have to understand that ISIS operates in a regional domestic circumstances and conditions, and you have to understand each and every one of these factors. I'll give you an example. You know, when you, as the United States, lines up or are being viewed by the Muslim Sunni world as if you are lining up and cooperating with the Iranians that are Shiites to eliminate the phenomenon of ISIS, one of the counterproductive is that you basically increase the number of people who recruits to ISIS because they are Sunnis. So that's one example of the need to really understand deeply the whole factors of the map, the whole moving parts.
Well, you've made a very substantial contribution to our understanding, Avi Melamed, with your new book, Inside the Middle East, Making Sense of the Most Dangerous and Complicated Region on Earth. In this book of yours, you have talked about what I believe is described as a chronology of failure with respect to U.S. policy towards this region. To what extent is one of that, the contributing factors to that, a failure to understand the ideology that is animating so much of this? Its adherents call it Sharia. There are other terms for it, but we seem to have sort of left that out of the mix. You've described Shiites versus Sunnis as one of the other blind spots here, but how would you characterize the most serious of the problems with American policy towards the Middle East at the moment?
Well, Frank, the cumulative failures of the U.S. policy in the Middle East goes back to some very fundamental flaws in the process within knowledge about the Middle East is gathered, analyzed, and processed within circles of powers in the United States and the West, like academia, like media, like non-governmental and governmental agencies. And it stems from mostly two major challenges. One is the fact that most of the Western mediators of knowledge, intellectuals and celebrities and non-governmental officers and activists and so forth, simply don't speak Arabic. The meaning of that is they have no ability, or a very limited ability, to really convey the accurate picture of the Middle East. You This is one thing. And the other challenge is the fact that, unfortunately, discussion about the Middle East, mostly in the West, in the last generation, in circles that supposed to provide real knowledge, like universities, that discussion became very shallow, very one-dimensional, many times unprofessional, and I would even say sometimes juvenile. And the combination of these two challenges result in an inaccurate reading of the reality of the Middle East, and inevitably, an inaccurate policy.
Let me ask, in that regard, one of the things that, as you know, has been very much a factor in American policy towards the region, particularly under the Obama administration, to some extent even under the Bush administration, has been a propensity of senior American policymakers to embrace and take counsel from the Muslim Brotherhood, or operatives of the Brotherhood doing business under a variety of front group organizations in this country. We saw Jordan actually moving against the Brotherhood just yesterday in its territories. To what extent is that a factor, as you see it, Avi Melman?
Well, you know, Frank, it represents what I'm saying. You know, there is a deeply misunderstanding in Western circles what the Muslim Brotherhood is about. The Muslim Brotherhood, to a large extent, share a vision that is not so much different from ISIS. The Muslim Brotherhood is viewing a world where you have a caliphate. The Muslim Brotherhood talks about a world that will be run according to the Islamic religious law called Sharia. The Muslim Brotherhood, like ISIS, view you, Frank, and every other Western people is morally inferior because, according to their outlook, you should be living your life according to the Islamic religious law because this is the master plan that Allah himself made for mankind. So that has to be internalized. And for some reason, obviously, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood has been engaged in what I'm calling smiling campaign. And there are so many people who really want to be convinced with the smiling campaign that they are willing just to put other things aside, or to look to the other way. By the way, the Muslim Brotherhood is designated today formally by Egypt and Saudi Arabia as a terror organization. And by the way, Frank, Muslim Brotherhood are experiencing a deep ideological and political crisis. Jordan is one place, Egypt is another place, Tunisia, Kuwait. In fact, this is a very deep crisis the Muslim Brothers are going through. But again, I don't know to say that to what extent really people in the West and mostly in circles of influence understand truly what is going on within the Muslim world. I don't know to say how much these people really understand what's the values that Muslim Brotherhood stands for. Muslim Brotherhood totally don't accept LGBT rights. Muslim Brotherhood don't think that there should be equality between women and men. And there are many other examples that basically manifest a very simple fact. Muslim Brotherhood does not share the values of Western civilization. He totally rejects
them. Amen. I mean, we're almost out of time. Let me just ask you one final question. Again, you served at the highest levels of the Israeli government. You've studied these matters closely. You do speak Arabic. You've deeply studied, of course, the nature of the enemy here. How would you regard the state of U.S.-Israeli relations, given that our government seems to have gotten so much of this so wrong?
Well, Frank, you know, Israel and the United States has a very long alliance, strategic alliance, and I would go and say beyond strategic alliance. We really share lots of values, lots of common outlooks, lots of beliefs. That being said, I must say that to my observation, some of these things are kind of like changing now. You know, the foundation is solid, it's wide, it's stable, yet I could see here and there cracks and rifts. Obviously, one of the reasons for that is, I would say, the very increasing presence of anti-Israel sentiments within different circles in the West that actually percolates into the discussion and impacts in some circles the way they look at Israel. Nevertheless, I think that we should emphasize time and again that the United States and Israel share very deep values, share long-term strategic interests. There is a mutual benefit of the relationships. All of these things valid and exist. However, we should also pay attention to other voices that are not so harmonic, so to speak, in that context, and we should monitor it very closely.
Avi Melamed, thank you very much for your time today. and for the work you're doing these days as a fellow of intelligence and Middle Eastern affairs for the Eisenhower Institute, Gettysburg College. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon. Next up, Michael Braun joins us. We'll talk about the war against the war on drugs. That and more, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
If you listen to this radio station a lot, you may have noticed our brand new name. It's got a catchy ring to it. But there's more than that. The name actually tells you who we are and what we do in one word. It took us a while to come up with this, but we realized if there's one thing we want to be to DC listeners, it was this. We want to be your answer to everything, to what happened while you slept, to why am I stuck in traffic, to how do you get control of this country again. Big stuff and little stuff. This may be a tall order for one radio station, but we know we're up for it. AM 1260, The Answer.
Hi, I'm Tim McGraw. The men and women of the Air Force Reserve play a vital role in protecting us at home and abroad. They are your neighbors, whose dedication to our country and commitment to their communities call them to serve. Dedication, commitment, and service. It happens every day at home and around the world. They're your neighbors, making a difference.
Joel Klein catches a 7 o'clock train after his evening CPR class at the American Red Cross.
Ron Garrity's on the same train. He's had a rough day and doesn't feel like himself. Until he feels the sudden tightness in his chest, Ron never thought he'd actually have a heart attack.
Until Joel is administering CPR, he never thought he'd actually save a life.
When you train with the Red Cross, you change a life.
Starting with your own.
Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org to learn about life-changing opportunities in your area.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts, now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined by one of the heroes of the war on drugs, a man who I've come to admire greatly for his service to our country at the Drug Enforcement Agency. where he served in a number of different capacities, including retiring as its assistant administrator and chief of operations. He is Michael Braun. These days, he is a managing partner at SGI Global, LLC, but he is very much our go-to guy on developments involving the threat to this country posed by drugs and those who traffic in them. Michael Braun, welcome back. It's always good to have you with us, sir.
Thanks, Frank. I appreciate the invitation to be with you this morning.
I know that in your previous life, at least, you worked with John Walters. John, of course, formerly served as the drug enforcement czar. He is now at the Hudson Institute, and he's written a sort of cri de coeur at Hudson about what's happening to his old organization. It seems, at least in his view, Michael Braun, that the Obama administration is sort of taking apart that organization, and in particular, the means by which we monitor how we're doing in countering the drug epidemic. Do you have any thoughts on this, and to what extent should we be concerned that our situational awareness is decreasing about an apparently growing threat?
Yeah, well, yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, I can tell you that I did work with John Walters, a great man, like all the drug czars who have served over the years, you know, Barry McCaffrey, Gil Kerlikowske, and even Botticelli, who is currently the drug czar. Listen, John's thoughts may hold merit, and here's why I say that. The numbers are in, and there's no mistake about it. There's no question. We experienced over 47,000 overdose deaths in the United States last year. We've never experienced that level of death due to drugs, both licit and illicit drugs in our nation's recorded history. And a lot of this has to do with we have absolutely taken our eye off the ball with respect to not only drug enforcement, but the other two very critically important parts to the, kind of three-part strategy of demand reduction, education, and prevention and treatment.
Our guest is Michael Braun. He served in senior ranks in the Drug Enforcement Administration. He is now with SGI Global, LLC. And Michael, you were just talking about sort of a three-legged stool, if you will, in terms of drug enforcement, counter-drug operations. Is it fair to say that each of those three elements is really under assault?
Yeah, I think they are. They simply, none of them have received the funding, levels of funding that they had in previous administrations. All are critically important to any counter-narcotics successful strategy. It's an important, important to understand that, our country has been dealing with drug abuse for 100+ years. It's part and parcel to living in a free and democratic society. Some choose to play by the rules, others don't. But I can tell you that if you don't have a great deal of focus on those three elements of drug strategy, then we're in trouble. And again, the numbers show it: 47,000 Americans, over 47,000 Americans died to drug overdose last year, and Frank, that's roughly 129 Americans every single day. Put that into comparison with Ebola. We had two reported cases in the United States. And how many billions of dollars did we throw at it? What are we doing with respect to drugs? We've released 6,000 hardened drug traffickers from our federal prisons. The sentencing guidelines and other things that have made our enforcement strategy so very successful over the years are under attack and will probably go away. It's an absolute mess.
There is, of course, this bipartisan effort. There are some Republicans, and not all by any means, but some Republicans who have decided they want to throw in with this idea of revising in the name of criminal justice reform, as you say, mandatory minimum sentences and retroactively apply them so as to wind up putting on the street people we're assured are, quote, nonviolent and generally minor criminal drug violators. in your professional experience and judgment, Michael Brown, it sounds as though you're saying that's pretty damn ill-advised. Is that right?
Well, I believe it is ill-advised. And I would tell you also, Frank, that, listen, there's been one study after another by both academia and government that have clearly shown minor drug offenders are not locked up in federal prisons for minor drug charges. It's simply not the case, and it's never been the case. And we've just, you know, we've just released or are in the process of releasing 6,000, you know, drug traffickers at the federal level from federal prisons, you know, right in the midst of, you know, this unbelievably enormous spike in drug abuse and addiction, you know, in our country. Look, you know, if you want to conduct another, you know, experiment, social experiment, at some point with respect to our nation's drug strategy, you know, let's wait a couple of years at least. Let's not do it right now in the midst of what we're facing.
And Michael, your experience, again, in the law enforcement business is also relevant with respect to one other aspect of this, and that is the recidivism rates, the degree to which we must expect that these 6,000, and that's probably just the tip of the iceberg of what will ultimately get back on the streets. But what do you think is likely to be the degree to which these folks find themselves back in the criminal business?
Back in the criminal business, absolutely. But with respect to the recidivism rate, listen, those 6,000 federal inmates that were locked up on federal drug trafficking charges, for the most part, by and large, were smart enough to never abuse drugs themselves because they realized clearly, you know, the danger of their own addiction. Now, these are the guys and gals that prey on the weak in society, and that's what I'm worried about, Frank.
Michael Brown, let me ask you about one other topic, and that is, as we've discussed in the past on a number of occasions, the degree to which not only is the demand clearly continuing to grow, and especially, I guess, with the degree of government support now for the use of marijuana, at least in a number of states, if not quite at the federal level. It certainly seems as though the feds are turning a blind eye towards the statutes that prohibit this kind of use. What is, in your experience, the likelihood that this is going to exacerbate the problem throughout the drug using demand chain?
Well, it is going to, listen, it's going to continue to exacerbate the problem. And a lot of it has to do with, you know, this idea that smoked marijuana is medicine. And I'm not talking about THC that's been extracted or synthetic THC that's found in Marinol, you know, that in some cases helps with cases of glaucoma and dealing with pain and that kind of thing, especially with respect to cancer. You know, that's not what I'm talking about. What most amazes me, Frank, is that with all of its faults, the FDA and our longstanding process for bringing legitimate drugs to market has been absolutely circumvented by ballot initiatives all over the United States, where Americans are now voting on what is a drug and what isn't a drug. And let me tell you something, our partners from around the world are looking at us and just absolutely scratching their heads and shaking their heads in absolute confusion.
Thank you for what you've done to both help elaborate those policies and execute them in the past.
Next up, The Daily Signal's Nolan Peterson joins us to discuss Vladimir Putin's ambitions. That and more, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
People from around the country have no clue what we're like here in Washington, D.C. Yeah, we've got our whack jobs like the guy who climbed the fence and walked around the White House. We have the people who see the black helicopters. But there's one common denominator for all of us, friends and family. And there's no place where relationship means more than it does right here. Yeah, we may be famous for the dignitaries, but friends and family, that makes us tick. And frankly, this radio station gets that. That's why I listen. AM 1260, The Answer.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. President Obama used CIA headquarters yesterday as a prop for his latest misleading assertions about the Islamic State. He no longer minimizes them as the JV team. He nonetheless boasts, "We have the momentum in a campaign to degrade and ultimately destroy ISIS." While some of its leaders have been killed or captured, the virulently jihadist group is widely seen as still being both willing and able to carry out spectacular terrorist attacks in the West. Worse yet, the Islamic State is but one manifestation of what is now truly a global jihad movement. It is that larger movement which is on the march and its animating totalitarian ideology, Sharia, that mortally threaten us. Barack Obama's persistent effort to obscure the reality of a metastasizing Islamic supremacist cancer by claiming tactical gains against one of its symptoms amounts to national security fraud. This is Frank Affney.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. Iran has made headlines lately due to a series of ballistic missile tests. It was written on some of these missiles, "Israel must be wiped off the face of the earth." The missile tests did not violate the July 2015 nuclear deal. Missiles were supposed to be in that deal, but were dropped at the last minute. As a result, sanctions against Iran that were lifted in the Iran deal cannot be reimposed due to the missile tests. The missile tests do violate UN Security Council resolutions, but UN sanctions will not be reimposed due to Russian and Chinese Security Council vetoes. Meaningful American sanctions won't be imposed because the Obama administration does not want to jeopardize President Obama's legacy nuclear agreement with Iran. So what does this mean? Despite the nuclear deal, Iran will continue to test ballistic missiles for the remainder of the Obama presidency, which are being developed as delivery systems for its nuclear weapons program. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say, joined once again by Nolan Peterson. These days, he is a foreign correspondent for the Heritage Foundation's Daily Signal in Ukraine, where we catch up with him. He is, however, also a man of many other parts, a former special operations pilot with combat experience in Iraq and Afghanistan. He has been doing some extraordinary freelance writing and journalism around the world. He is the Medill National Security Journalism Initiative Fellow as well. And always welcome here. Nolan, it's good to catch up with you. Thank you for taking a few minutes.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, we're marking the day that Vladimir Putin does his annual call-in telethon with his folks. It is generally, I think, a performance rather than a particularly insightful exercise. But I wonder if you might shed some light on what you think he's up to, particularly through the prism of what you've seen firsthand in Ukraine. And we'll talk about some of his aspirations and operations elsewhere as well. But let's sort of set the stage for it by talking about what you're seeing firsthand there in Ukraine, Nolan.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the situation here in Ukraine, although it fades from the headlines from time to time, is still very serious. There's still active fighting going on in the east. I was just out in the front lines a couple weeks ago, and I was there for artillery attacks. There are reports of tank battles. Sniper shots are constant. So it's still, you know, a low-intensity war, limited in geography, going on in eastern Ukraine. But I think that underscores the seriousness of what's going on here. What, you know, if you look at what Putin was saying during his call-in show today, which you're right is somewhat of a farce, you know, he laid blame on the Panama Papers revelations on the U.S., saying it was some sort of American backed scheme to degrade his reputation in Russia. And I think that just it is representative of a larger pattern of Russia painting the United States and NATO in general as an enemy. And they do that, and the Kremlin does that, in particular to validate or to justify Putin's continual existence in power.
Let me stay with Ukraine for just a moment. Maybe we'll come back to those related points. You've written that this war, which, as you say, is still underway, may spike here shortly as the fighting season climate there begins to lend itself to fresh military operations. Is your sense, Nolan Peterson, that Putin will be engaging in intensified hostilities? And make no mistake about it, those are Russian forces that are at work here. Is that right?
Very true. Yeah, there's ample evidence that regular Russian soldiers are out there fighting in the battles in eastern Ukraine. As far as predicting what Putin's going to do, I think one lesson I've learned the last 2 years of reporting on this conflict is to never go on the record predicting what Putin's going to do, because he always surprises you. But I think, like I said, you know, the pattern of him creating these foreign crises to justify his continued presence, his continued power in Russia, is that sort of his go-to maneuver. His popularity in Russia spiked enormously after Russia annexed Crimea in 2014. So he knows that he can get domestic popularity numbers in Russia with, you know, launching operations in Syria and supporting operations in eastern Ukraine. So as soon as you see him take a dip in popularity in Russia, I think that's when there's a real risk that he might expand his operations militarily abroad.
And has he suffered some dip as a result of disclosures in the Panama Papers? Were his offshore dealings exposed?
I haven't seen any reports from Russia to show that he took a serious or noticeable dip in popularity. I think, you know, the situation in Russia is very similar to the one in Ukraine, where the populations in these countries are just so used to corruption that it doesn't surprise them that much. You know, most of these people have grown up in the Soviet Union, and really the millennial generation is the only generation for whom the Soviet history here is more of a, it's not a fresh memory, it's something they've read in history books. But among older Ukrainians and older Russians, they're just used to that, and so it doesn't shock them, and so they don't turn on our leaders for when they are exposed for these corrupt practices. So I don't really perceive that Putin will suffer that much from the Panama Papers, if at all.
Does the fact that he is as aggressively hostile to NATO as he has been, and makes no secret of it, likely to translate in your expectation? And I understand what you're saying about crystal ball gazing with respect to Putin, but we've seen sort of late a ratcheting up of his threats to Western interests and allies in the Baltic region, notably the buzzing of a U.S. Navy destroyer. You're a former special operations pilot, Nolan Peterson. I'd ask you for sort of your professional judgment as to what that was about. It certainly seems like a direct provocation to me, but what do you think?
Yeah, well, there are a lot of military experts who think that the Baltics could be the next stepping stone, or the next place where Putin could exert his, you know, his military force. And so there is I think everything Putin does militarily is, in my opinion, based on what I've seen, is mainly for the domestic audience. It really is to keep the Russian people on his side. And so I, you know, speaking, it's my personal opinion, I don't think it would be in his interests to launch a serious military operation or war in the Baltics. If he did that, they would prompt NATO to declare Article 5, which would mean a war between NATO and Russia, which could become a nuclear war. And I think, you know, that sounds crazy to say, but it could actually happen. But what really worries me is that these provocations, like the flyby of the Navy ship, and other things that, you know, there's continual flybys of Russian jets to the Baltics, those sorts of things have the potential to turn into an accident, to be misperceived by one side or the other. And I call it the Franz Ferdinand scenario, where that one unexpected sort of, you know, butterfly effect event happens and the whole house of cards crumbles. And I think that's what people should be worried about, is that things could spiral out of control because of a mistake. not because of a deliberate provocation or because Putin wants to start World War III, but because he's pushing that envelope. You know, he's playing on the edge, and I think things could spiral out of control accidentally.
And he, like a lot of other foreign leaders, bad guys, have taken the measure of this president, and I think calculated they may be able to get away with some of this, especially if his larger purpose, as you say, Nolan, may well be trying to get even with NATO for its success in helping bring down the Soviet Union, the greatest catastrophe of the 20th century, as he calls it. But Nolan, let me just ask you, should we, as Congressman Mike Pompeo, a friend of this program, has suggested elsewhere today, be laying out in no uncertain terms for the Russians and others what our rules of engagement will be? I mean, flyby doesn't quite do justice to, you know, buzzing at very low level in close proximity, by one estimate, as much as 30 feet from one of these aircraft passing by our ship, those will be intercepted and brought down if they continue.
That's certainly the, you know, the decision of the president, and you know, it comes down to military commander's judgment. I mean, I would have to say that, you know, a provocation like that is probably not worth starting a shooting war with Russia over. And I think too, I mean, I think it's important to remember that those images of those Russian warplanes buzzing U.S. Navy vessels, that plays in Russia. And people like that in Russia. That generates national pride in Russia to see that. They think Russia is standing up to NATO.
But that's partly why I'm asking the question, is I think you're likely to see more of it for that reason, and Putin's larger designs. And it does require, exercising some judgment and dealing with the pucker factor. But it does seem to me this may be, as Mike Pompeo suggested, a moment where you need to make clear that this will not be tolerated and discourage them from engaging it in the future. Nolan Peterson, we have to leave it at that for the moment. I'm sorry to say we've got so much more to talk about. I hope you'll indulge us and talk with us again in the near future. But in the meantime, stay safe over there in Ukraine, and keep up the great work that you do at the Daily Signal, and come back to us soon. Next up, we'll speak with Gordon Chang about developments in South China Sea and an important strategic moment, perhaps, for the U.S.-India relationship right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, we have served our nation as a force in readiness.
Get some rear security.
From combat operations to humanitarian assistance in every corner of the world. No matter where the mission takes us today, or wherever our country needs us tomorrow, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for each other, for our nation, for us all. The few, the proud, the Marines.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Every year, more American adults die from vaccine-preventable diseases than from breast cancer, traffic accidents, or AIDS. Vaccines like the one for pneumococcal disease can protect adults from illnesses that can cause missed days of work, hospitalization, and even death. Pneumococcal disease is an infection that can lead to pneumonia, meningitis, or even a severe blood infection. That's just one example of an infection that can spread from person to person. Getting vaccinated can help protect you and those close to you. I'm Dr. Susan Rehm of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. When I speak with my patients, I urge them to get all their recommended vaccines. Now I'm urging you to speak with your doctor to find out which vaccines you need. For more information about the vaccines that are recommended for adults and the diseases they prevent, like HPV, whooping cough, tetanus, and shingles, visit adultvaccination.org. That's www.adultvaccination.org.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
I lost my healthy 27-year-old son to influenza. Jacob wasn't someone you'd expect to die from the flu. He was strong, a martial arts athlete. After 5 weeks of fighting, Jacob died.
I'm Dr. Bill Schaffner of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. Each year, influenza claims the lives of Americans of all ages, including healthy young adults like Jacob. Ask about vaccination the next time you're at your doctor's office or pharmacy. Visit adultvaccination.org.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It is time for our weekly visit with one of the country's preeminent authorities on the Far East. He is Gordon Chang. You'll find his work at The Daily Beast, Forbes.com, World Affairs Journal, Fox News, and so many other places. We're always privileged to have him here with us each week. He's the author of two terrific books, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and The Coming Collapse of China. Gordon, welcome back. Good to have you as always.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Well, the Secretary of Defense, Ash Carter, has been out in the area of the world that's in your portfolio, visits to, among other things, India and the Philippines, and not to China. Give us sort of your take on the implications of his trip and some news that he made while he was out there.
The big story about Carter's trip, well, there are so many storylines, but the really big one is where he did not go. He did not go to China. He canceled the visit there, and that is going to have enormous implications. Where he did go, people are talking about his visit to the Philippines because of the inking of the agreement for the U.S. having access or expanded access to five facilities, plus also the announcement of joint U.S.-Philippine patrols in the South China Sea, which, of course, is extremely important, especially because of Scarborough Shoal and events there. But there's something that people, I think, have missed, largely because it was words. But nonetheless, these words certainly were heard in Beijing, and that is when Carter was in India, he said that the U.S. and India should be strategic partners for the 21st century. This builds upon relations that go back to the administration of George W. Bush, who really started to reorient American foreign policy towards the subcontinent, which is absolutely the correct thing to do. And now this whole thing about skipping Beijing is fascinating. It comes after, we should mention, that the Pentagon did not permit the Chinese foreign minister to visit a couple months ago, and that is starting to establish a very good pattern where we are no longer feeding this inflated sense of self-importance of the Chinese.
Gordon, in terms of next steps with respect to a strategic relationship with India, what would you expect to see there?
I think the important thing for the United States, and this is because this is an uncertain future, is more joint development programs of military items, as well as actually selling the Indians in things like planes. We haven't done as well as we should in this regard, especially because of our need to work much more closely with India. We need to have compatible equipment, and so therefore, this is going to be, I think, the critical item going forward. But on other fronts, the Indian-U.S. military relationship is growing very quickly, and part of it is because, you know, India had used to look to the Russians for equipment, and the Indians had had this informal agreement with Moscow that the Russians would not sell to the Chinese anything more advanced than they were selling to India. That seems to no longer be true. The Russians are selling some very sophisticated equipment to the Chinese, including the S-400 air defense system, and so India has now got to look elsewhere. This is an advantage that we need to capitalize on, and so far we haven't done as much as we should in this regard, but I'm sure that we will make progress in the future, and in the not-too-distant future at that.
Let me ask you about one other subject that's very much on, I think, both of our minds, and that is something you addressed in your Forbes column this week about China seizing technology, really extorting Western firms, including ours, doing business in China, to give up the seed corn of their technologies as they're seen as competitors to prospective Chinese businesses. Are American companies, among others in the West, going along with this sort of shakedown? And what are the implications of that, Gordon, commercial as well as potentially strategic?
Yeah, the implications are just so important because this is the crown jewels of the United States, our technology of our corporates. China, for decades, of course, has tried to obtain it. Their most recent initiative goes back to about a year ago, last April. And in that regard, they are trying to adopt the concept of essential facilities, which is essentially that they're saying that Western technology is so important that unless it is shared with Chinese competitors on terms favorable to the Chinese competitors, this would be an anti-monopoly violation. The essential facilities doctrine has been around in one form or another for 100 years. It hasn't caught on in the United States to the extent it has elsewhere. And right now, we are seeing the Chinese try to take advantage of this with, first of all, proposed regulations. And recently, in the last 3 weeks, they have issued some guidelines in proposed form that would be especially disadvantageous to our companies. This is subject to negotiation at the highest levels between the United States and China, but the Chinese seem determined on this, and we need to pay much more attention because this is going to be who determines who sells things in the next decade is who owns the technology and under what terms it is licensed.
This is all the more extraordinary since the Chinese have been pretty good at simply stealing what they wanted from Western companies and defense contractors and even governments. Does this really mark a substantial change, as you see it, Gordon, in the likelihood they'll get their hands on what they seek?
If they were to issue their guidelines in the form that they want, this would be a substantial advantage for them. This comes after the prosecution of Qualcomm, which essentially was forced to license two Chinese companies at much lower fees.
And pay a $1 billion fine on top of it. Is that right?
They paid a $975 million fine to China. This was, first of all, quite a large fine, also unprecedented. And it sort of heralded what the Chinese were going to do with this essential facilities doctrine. Yes, the Chinese can steal a lot, but nonetheless, American companies are getting much better at countering what the Chinese are doing. And, of course, the U.S. government is becoming much more active in terms of preventing cyber espionage. So the Chinese sort of have been blocked on one front to a certain extent. So now they're trying another one, which is to actually get licenses from U.S. companies on terms which they would not agree to in other countries.
Gordon, let me lastly turn to some musing that you've been doing about the North Koreans. As you say, they've been taking on the world for some time. What is the latest with respect to the evidence that they're seemingly now much, much more aggressively inclined towards their longtime patron, China?
Yeah, there has been a number of developments which indicate that civilian-to-civilian ties between Beijing and Pyongyang have broken down. But we got to remember that this is a dual-track relationship between China and North Korea. And in the military-to-military realm, which in some ways is much more important to us and to South Korea and Japan, it's not exactly clear that the breakdown has been mirrored among the flag officers on both sides. This is important because in the next few days, many people expect the North Koreans to do something they've never done before, which is to test a mobile missile. The reason why this is relevant to China is because North Korea would not have mobile launchers for their missiles if it were not for the Chinese. We saw that the mobile launcher for the KN-08, which the North Koreans paraded first in 2012, that comes from China. And they've now got a new variant of that, the KN-14, which seems to be a little bit longer range and perhaps more accurate. So that's a real threat to the United States, courtesy Beijing. And we need to be very careful of a mobile missile because we can't kill it on the ground.
For the moment, we have to leave it at that. Thank you very much, as always, for this update on what's happening in your portfolio in Asia. Nobody covers it better than you at The Daily Beast, at Forbes.com, Fox News, and elsewhere. Thanks for joining us each week as well. I hope the rest of you will do so again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.